Who was he? Who was HM?
He was a young man who developed epilepsy in his teenage years that gradually became worse and worse. He had some jobs as an assembly line worker. He came from the northeast of the United States. But eventually his seizures became so frequent that he couldn't lead a normal life. And at that point he was offered an experimental surgery to relieve the epilepsy. As we read it from other accounts, he was so incapacitated by his seizures that they couldn't be controlled by conventional or even high doses of anticonvulsant medication. Couldn't work anymore, couldn't lead a normal life, was having seizures frequently, sometimes daily. He was in a desperate situation.
To the world, he was known as HM, and his identity shrouded in mystery. After experimental surgery for major epilepsy in 1953, he became severely amnesic and was to live the rest of his life in the perpetual present, forgetting nearly every moment as it happened, unable to make new long-term memories. And he died at age 82, just a year and a half ago.
Well, HM really inaugurated the modern era of memory research. He was described in the medical literature and the scientific literature in 1957, was studied for decades until he passed away in 2008, and he established a number of fundamental principles about how the brain has organized its memory functions. These are principles that still guide research today.
HM, now revealed to be Henry Gustav Mollison, stands out as perhaps the most famous patient of 20th century neuroscience. So much so, in December last year, the dissection of his brain was broadcast live on the internet to mark that historic occasion. And on All in the Mind on ABC Radio National today, Natasha Mitchell here, taking you back in time to consider HM's legacy with the leading scientists who worked with him and to encounter his brain in the flesh in San Diego.
These are very vivid episodic memories. I reconstruct the whole thing. He never learned to he never recognized me. He never knew who in the world I was. He spent a week in Montreal once, but he just never really gets to know people in that way. But was very, very cooperative right through to the end of his life. He died at the age of 82. He was 29, I think, when I first worked with him. Always very cooperative and good-humoured.
Pioneering Canadian neuropsychologist and living legend, Professor Brenda Milner, who turns 92 next month, and I'm told she still heads to a lab at McGill University every day. She co-authored the first paper about HM in 1957 and continued to work with him until his death.
It's a very strange thing, this, you know. People interviewed me when he died, and how do you feel? And you feel as though you've lost a friend. And this is it's a little aside, but it's a rather bizarre thing, because most of us, I think of friendship as a reciprocal thing, a relationship between people. And yet I feel, and I know that Susan Corkin, my former student who studied him more than I have in recent years, also feels she's lost a very good friend. And yet this person doesn't know us. So that one's feeling of friendship can indeed be very unilateral, rather strange.
We're standing in Larry Squire's office, and a wall of photos here, a sort of hall of fame of memory research, I gather.
Yeah, places I've been and people I've met. What we're looking at here is taken at McGill University out on the street on the occasion of the 85th birthday festschrift for Brenda Milner, and here's Brenda standing in the middle.
She looks in her element. She's surrounded by, seven men in suits, and there she is in the middle.
Yeah.
In the office of Larry Squire, Professor of Psychiatry, Neurosciences and Psychology at the University of California, San Diego. Modest though he is, this man is a superhero in the field of modern memory research. He's co-author of the authoritative book Memory, From Mind to Molecules, with the Nobel laureate and fellow memory researcher Eric Kandel. And like Brenda Milner, early in his scientific career as a student, Larry met HM.
In fact, this is Sue Corkin, who was the one who studied HM.
And she was Brenda's student.
Yep, and she came to MIT in 1964 and continued to study HM up until his death.
I think it's remarkable that these two women scientists tracked him for their entire careers.
Yeah, that's right. And Sue's students then participated as colleagues in that enterprise. This is a picture of Hans Lucas Teuber, who was the head of the department at MIT and the one who introduced me to HM.
But as you'll hear, before HM was a man called PB, Brenda Milner.
My task was to explore the functions of the human temporal lobe, about which really very little was known. The typical temporal lobectomy, and this is the first important point that you do for the treatment of epilepsy, and is still a very successful way of treating epilepsy to this day of this kind that has its origin in one temporal lobe, is unilateral. That's to say, the surgeon operates only on one half of the brain. And we were able to compare the effects of removals in the left hemisphere, the speaking hemisphere, with those in removal on the other side. And there were small memory changes, and if it was from the left side, it was to do with memory for words, to language. If it was from the right side, it was affecting a little one's memory for faces and places and tunes, non-verbal, non-linguistic. But these changes were very mild effects. And in exchange for that, the control of the epilepsy was really changing their quality of life and was also often showing improvement on general tests of intelligence. And all this was going very smoothly, and I was collecting all my results when suddenly we had a really great surprise, and certainly for Dr. Penfield a great unpleasant shock, was when one patient, 46-year-old engineer, whom we call PB, from New Jersey, came to have a left temporal removal. PB came back and had his operation in two stages because the first superficial one had not cured him. And after the second operation, this highly intelligent man, whom I had tested preoperatively extensively, said rather angrily, a little bitterly, "What have you people done to my memory?" And he had from then on what we call a continuous anterograde amnesia, a forgetting of the events of his life as he moved forward, so that he couldn't remember if his wife had been to see him that day. He couldn't remember what he had had for breakfast. He said as he woke up in the morning, it was buzzing, booming confusion. But then in his case, gradually he would say that right now everything is clear. And all these patients, those few patients actually, that I have seen with this kind of amnesia, this kind of forgetfulness, say this: right now everything is clear. So we have short-term memory preserved, but we have this inability to transfer information into a long-term storage.
Professor Brenda Milner speaking on PBS Television's Charlie Rose Show earlier this year. And like a game of pin the tail on the donkey, this moment she recounts represents the first time an aspect of our memory system was localised in the brain. So they wrote up the experience of the patient called PB, and with that, everything about the science of memory was about to change.
Then Dr. Penfield got a telephone call from a neurosurgeon in Hartford, Connecticut, Dr. William Scoville, who called and said, "I've just read the abstract with interest because I think that the memory loss that you are describing in your two patients is similar to the memory loss that I have seen in a patient in whom I carried out my operation." Dr. Scoville's operations differed. First of all, he was operating on both sides of the brain.
I was living all those years referring to him as HM, and then to a few close colleagues we'd say Henry, but no one ever used his last name.
No one ever saw his photos. He was really kept incognito, wasn't he?
Oh, very much. He was protected.
When he was 27, it's 1953, and enter an acclaimed surgeon, William Scoville from Connecticut. And he proposed an experimental procedure. How experimental was this procedure, and why did he propose it?
It was known at the time that a particular part of the brain in the temporal lobes is particularly sensitive to seizures and thought to be the source of some seizures. He had tried this surgery previously on psychotic patients during an era when that kind of neurosurgery was more common than it is today. With that background, knowing that there was a target for surgery that made some sense in terms of relieving epilepsy, and the fact that he had carried it out previously in psychotic patients, that then led to this proposal that he try out with HM. And the family agreed to this, and so the surgery took place in 1953.
Larry, take us inside the medial temporal lobe. It's just sits sort of just inside of the ear, doesn't it?
Yeah, so the temporal lobe is located in the lower part of the brain, so is it about the position of the ear, and the medial temporal lobe refers to the inside of the temporal lobe, So it's a deep structure, not easily accessible. A number of structures were involved in the surgery within this geographical area that we call the medial temporal lobe.
Of course, Larry, we didn't have brain scans then, so it was kind of flying blind. I mean, in retrospect, we know what was taken out in that surgery. What was taken out?
Well, what was taken out by the surgery was on both sides of the brain, the hippocampus, which was the structure best known at the time, but also taken out was the tissue adjacent to and below the hippocampus, which includes structures that now have the names of perirhinal cortex and the entorhinal cortex.
On September the 1st, 1953, a bilateral medial temporal lobe resection was carried out, extending posteriorly for a distance of 8 centimetres from the midpoints of the tips of the temporal lobes, with the temporal horns constituting the lateral edges of resection. Scoville and Milner, 1957.
You know, his epilepsy was controlled, but something incredibly catastrophic happened to his memory after that surgery. He described it as like waking in a dream every day as alone in itself.
Well, it was immediately recognized that he had a severe memory impairment. He forgot the events of the passing moments nearly as fast as they occurred, really what we would call a failure to form long-term stable memories.
In the moment, what was that like for him?
Well, I mean, we now know that memory impairment can be even more severe than it was in HM, and subsequent testing showed that HM was capable of some amount of new learning. Roughly speaking, it meant that he couldn't keep track of any ongoing events, couldn't form relationships or have any kind of real social communication. So he became completely disabled by the memory loss.
And he was an amnesic. Became the most famous amnesic.
This frankly experimental operation was considered justifiable because the patient was totally incapacitated by his seizures, and these had proven refractory to a medical approach.
Remember, at the time, in 1957, when the work was published, when the results of the surgery that he underwent because of his epilepsy, at the time, very little was known about memory process.
Neuroanatomist Professor Jacopo Annese.
I remember that HM was also the basis for what then became modern neuroscience of memory, with animal models that essentially people were trying to recreate the same lesion that the surgeon did, I wouldn't say randomly because the surgery was planned, but that he did so elegantly on a human being, and that was never repeated again. This also makes HM unique. What makes HM unique is also the fact that his amnesia was stable over the years and remained stable. It was a global amnesia. And I think, if I may say, what made HM unique is that he was so willing to work with researchers, because if he hadn't been, I don't think we would know this much.
This case was known to everyone almost as soon as the publication took place, because up to that point, we didn't have any sense of memory being a separate function of the brain, or we didn't have any idea about how memory was organized. The inherited wisdom was the idea that memory was distributed through the rest of the cortex and heavily integrated with perceptual and intellectual functions. So the finding from HM, the fundamental finding, taught us that memory is dissociable, is a specific function of a certain part of the brain. And the person who was really responsible for making this point so clearly was Brenda Milner, who did the original work on HM when she was finishing her graduate work at McGill University. But I think it was Brenda's insight and her skills as a scientist and as an observer that really brought out the importance of HM and made him clearly a patient that one had to understand in order to understand memory.
It's amazing to me how HM became so important later on, whereas when we were discovering these things, there was so much skepticism, not so much among neurologists, but great skepticism among my fellow scientists. And this was because there was the prevailing view about memory. First of all, memory was not really a very fashionable topic in those days. I remember the famous neuropsychologist Alexander Luria writing to me and saying, memory was the sleeping beauty of the brain, and now she is awake. And so here is a patient with supposedly these big damage in just this medial temporal region and nowhere else. This is very fishy. How can it have such a huge effect on memory? There was a lot of skepticism.
Professor Brenda Milner speaking at McGill University recently, and on ABC Radio National's All in the Mind, going global on Radio Australia and online with me, Natasha Mitchell. This is the iconic story of HM, a man whose unusual form of amnesia transformed his life and the study of memory. You met him when you were a graduate student. He was probably in his 40s then. Tell us about that meeting and what the conversation was like.
Well, it stopped short of a real conversation, but he was visiting MIT at the time for a period of testing.
Professor Larry Squire.
I was brought in where HM was sitting and was introduced to him. And I had always thought that HM gave me a kind of smile of the sort that would be appropriate if you knew who the person was, and also appropriate if you didn't know who the person was, because he certainly had never met me before, but of course he didn't know that. I think he was accustomed to not knowing anything, and so he had a sort of a quiet, soft smile in response to those things that would be appropriate under a wide range of conditions.
The extraordinary thing was that in the moment he couldn't remember the immediacy of an exchange, but he did have some memory. He had some historical memory, didn't he? What was retained?
So first of all, what was preserved was what we call immediate memory, and that means our ability to repeat back a telephone number, carry on a conversation. So he was intact in his ability to behave and operate in the immediate moment. He could repeat back digits just like you and I. He could carry on a conversation as long as it didn't last too long or move around different topics that required referring back.
I meet HM. I started giving him a few numbers to remember, and he was doing very well. And so I thought, well, he's got to forget something soon. I was very naive. This was 1950-something. So I said, I'm going to give you three numbers. I want you to remember them. I'm going to go out, and I'll come back in a while. So I gave him the numbers 584, and I went out and had a cup of coffee with Dr. Scoville's secretary, and I came back in 20 minutes. And I said, what was the number? And he said, 584. I was really surprised. So I said, that's very good. How do you do it? Well, he said, 5, 8, and 4. That adds up to 17. Divide by 2, you have 9 and 8. And then 9 divided by 2, you have 5 and 4. 5, 8, 4, it's simple. And I said, that's very good. And do you remember my name? He said, no, I'm sorry, it's trouble. I have trouble with my memory. And so, so I told him again.
Secondly, he had historical memories of the remote past. Initially, that was thought to involve memories up to about within 3 years of his surgery. Later on, it was thought to maybe extend up to maybe 11 years before his surgery. But it was always apparent on formal testing that he had good knowledge of events and facts, famous people, the names of people, the things that would have become known to him during the 1930s, 1940s, before he had his surgery. And then thirdly, perhaps the most fundamental discovery, which occurred later, was the fact that his memory impairment really only extends to a particular type of memory. That's the kind of memory that we call declarative memory. Declarative memory is our conscious memory for facts and events. So in one sense, that sounds like all of memory, because we think of memory as being conscious memory, and that's how we use the term memory in everyday language. Mm. But he was preserved in other forms of memory, things that really are expressed through performance as unconscious effects of experience. So, for example, skills, habits, certain kinds of Pavlovian conditioning, things that are done that turn out to depend on other brain systems than the system that was damaged in him.
And it was your work, in fact, that really was fundamental to producing that taxonomy between declarative memory and all the other memories. You did that work with colleagues and published in the 80s. Many have contemplated what his life internally was like.
Yes, and I think the literature is enormous. There are some very rigorous experiments about what type of memory he had preserved and what type of tasks he could perform. There are other questions that are more philosophical, whether the sense of self that he developed over the years. I always ask myself the question of what type of dreams he might have. Were his dreams confined to the period of his life that he still maintained as an autobiographical memory, which was, it seems, up to when he was 16. So maybe his oniric scenarios were those of a young boy or teenager. We don't know.
I mean, we don't know whether he dreamed in the present or not.
No, exactly. Of what past he dreamt of. I suppose that he dreamt about the time that he also remembers consciousness. But, you know, this is very interesting.
It raises some interesting ethical questions about that relationship between scientists and their human subjects, doesn't it? Because was he able to continue to consent in the moment to being a subject of scientific research? Has that given pause for thought for scientists working with him and others?
Yeah, well, typically what happens with a patient who is disabled to the extent of HM is that a conservator is appointed for the patient, and the conservator needs to give consent along with the patient. Now, he was not demented, which creates even more of these kinds of issues, because he did maintain his premorbid intelligence, and he certainly understood the requests made to him of participating. So he was able to give consent himself, but in addition, patients like this typically have a conservator that's appointed.
I wonder how he viewed his scientific fame. Was he aware of his notoriety in the scientific literature and amongst memory researchers like yourself?
Well, to a limited degree, I think. I mean, the patients that we study, the ones who are very severely impaired, don't really understand it, but they do develop an appreciation for the visits and for the process of participating. I mean, HM, I think, said once that he knew that understanding his condition might help others and that he was glad for that. So I think he did have some limited understanding that he was appreciated.
He died December 2 years ago at age 82, ripe age. What had his life been for those last 40 years? I mean, was he independent in any way, or was he in permanent care?
He was in a chronic care facility during those last decades. He watched television. He worked on crossword puzzles, basing it on skills that he had developed. You know, he could read and so on, but all these skills that he would have learned as a younger person.
If he was reading a book, though, would he get to the end of a paragraph and have forgot what preceded?
Yes, he would have very much success at reading.
A man who donated his life in some sense, and this is the challenging undercurrent of this whole story. HM also donated his brain at death to those who had committed their careers to investigating why his memory worked the way it did. What had to happen to get his brain to you in an intact state? I imagine that was a very sort of tense sequence of events.
The most important thing for me was that the brain would be preserved quickly, because it's very important the time between death and when the brain is actually fixed in formalin. It's very important to then be able to highlight the features that we needed to study.
Dr. Jacopo Annese, who heads up the Brain Observatory at the University of California, San Diego.
HM's body was transported to the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston from the nursing home in Connecticut. And I eventually made a red-eye flight direct from San Diego to Boston, so I was able to be there at 6:30 the next morning. They brought me to the Massachusetts General Hospital, and everything was ready for the autopsy. At that point, the brain, together with Dr. Matthew Frosch, we removed the brain, and that's when you sort of draw your first... You know, because you know that that part has gone well. And the brain now was safely in a very large container with this chemical that would have essentially stopped the brain from deteriorating. It's called chemical fixation.
Well, just outside of San Diego City, I've landed at a very special place called the Brain Observatory. The word is observatory, but you're not gazing into the galaxy above us. You're actually gazing into, a sense, the galaxy inside us, aren't you?
Pretty much, yes. We turned the telescope around to look inside our brain.
And to construct three-dimensional virtual models of the brains of people who generously donate their precious organs to science after they die. But the dissection of HM's brain was a major undertaking, and new techniques needed to be fine-tuned because they wanted to do it whole to preserve the original surgical lesion made back in 1953. Precious cargo for you to be bringing across from the west coast of USA to the east coast here in San Diego. Every brain is special, but this was a man who was iconic in the history of neuroscience.
Yeah, I like the term special cargo. Yes, I mean, at that point it was under my responsibility. From the moment that we prepared for the autopsy, the brain was under my responsibility. And there was a concern whether, you know, with the regulations, we could have brought a container with more than 1 liter of fixative, dangerous chemicals. But when we were able to arrange with the airline company a safe transport, in fact, they gave us a seat, one for me and one for Henry Mollison. And I remember arriving at the lab, we had already installed extra security on the doors, and when I moved the brain from the traveling container to another very spacious bucket, you know, for the long-term fixation. Then again, it was a second moment in which I said something that I would say many times after that, like, so far, so good. You know, things have gone very, very well. So once the brain is completely frozen, then it's attached to this machine, and it runs underneath the blade. Now, we use 5 blades for the brain of HM. We kept changing them so that they would always be sharp. And the thickness that we cut at was 70 microns. It takes 1,000 microns to make a millimeter. So the thickness of that slice was 70 of this unit. So it's very, very, very thin. And that's why the brain had to be frozen and kept frozen.
Wow, 53 hours and 2,401 slices later. Just this past month, you have been starting to stain some of those sections of HM's brain. Let's take a look at this series of specimen drawers. So we're just opening out one drawer now, and oh my gosh, there's a section of HM's brain. Wow. So fine. Very thin specimen on a big glass slide.
So a trained eye can see that there is something wrong with the anatomy here, because we should have a structure called the hippocampus in this area, and there is none. So, in fact, it is quite amazing to think that this is where the surgeon in 1953 was actually rubbing his cannula and removing the tissue.
It's really quite moving for me to see this man's brain in the flesh after having read about him for so many years while he was still alive. And it looks like HM's brain is still offering up new knowledge. After all, he had some capacity to remember, and here is perhaps why.
With the naked eye, you see that there is a very dark layer, and this is the hippocampus. So this is actually the part of the hippocampus that Dr. Scoville left behind, even though he thought he had taken it. Now, MRI showed, HM sat for a couple of MRI scanning sessions when he was alive in 1992 and in the late 90s. And so the researchers for the first time realized that there was some tissue left. But of course, this is the first time that you can actually see what that tissue was. Now we know, we see the dentate gyrus, and we haven't published these results yet, but it is amazing to think that this is probably where information still trickled in and made it through this impasse of his lesion. And we're talking about the memories that somehow he could make while he was an amnesic.
And so the story of HM continues in this laboratory here at the Brain Observatory. Well, thank you for this introduction to a man who really redefined neuroscience to HM's brain. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Jacopo Annese with HM, a man whose brain just seems to keep on giving. As people now piece together the story of his life in concert with the microstructure of his organ of thought.
And the hippocampus is a really simple structure, and we know the connectivity, and we've known the anatomy for a long time. But no one ever thought it was going to be possible to knock out one connection within the hippocampus and ask what happens there. And those techniques are becoming possible now, and this is all work done with mice. And so it's really a whole new era. I mean, it only goes back about 10 years. I mean, neuroimaging only goes back 10 or 15 years, and that's exciting. And all this genetic possibilities only goes back 10 or 15 years. So we're entering a whole new era of what's going to become possible, and the coming years are going to be every bit as exciting as the years that we've gone by.
Larry Squire, thank you for joining me on the program. It's been a great pleasure and privilege to talk to you.
Thank you.
And my thanks today to Larry Squire, Jacopo Annese, Brenda Milner and to McGill University. Lots of extra audio on my blog this week on the story of HM, including more on the ethical questions I think this case really raises. And from my visit to the Brain Observatory, a photo gallery too. All that, lots of links, the audio transcript and more via the All in the Mind website, abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind, where you can be part of the discussion too. Look for Add Your Comment on this week's story. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Thanks to co-producer Corin Podger and sound engineer Tim Simons. Next week, Liar Liar Pants on Fire. BP has used a giant pair of shears to cut a pipe and is getting ready to try to place a cap over it.
We think of oil rigs as sort of a platform, an oil platform that's anchored to the sea bottom, but Deepwater Horizon is actually a ship.
And it's a ship flying a flag of convenience. Kerry Phillips here from Rear Vision. Hope you can join me for a story of oil and water. Flags of convenience, Rear Vision. And you can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.